You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin is pushing back against a proposed mine on the Wisconsin-Michigan border. We'll hear the details from a reporter and the tribal chairman. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The Department of Natural Resources voted to put new restrictions in place for large farms in eastern Wisconsin. A paper manufacturer founded in Wisconsin announced layoffs and plant closings, and the Milwaukee Brewers' famous racing sausages are getting a new sponsor. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, Rob, we've talked a lot on the show before about the problem of contaminated drinking water, especially in Kewaunee County due to manure runoff. The DNR taking some steps this week. What is happening?
Sure. So this is a somewhat scaled-down version of what the DNR initially proposed, which would have restricted manure spreading all over the state. Of course, dairy farmers did not like that. They do have political power in the state. And so what we got instead were restrictions that will affect these 15 counties in the east of Wisconsin, sort of running down the eastern coast of the state, because they are places where there's a particular type of bedrock under the soil that manure and contaminants can seep through and into groundwater, so they're seen as at higher risk. That's why we had the problems in Kewaunee County that you described, and that's where these new restrictions will take effect.
And as I understand it, this doesn't mean no manure spreading at all. It's limiting places where the soil is not deep enough to prevent the runoff, and then limiting application in some other areas. Is that right?
Right. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, manure is excellent fertilizer, right? I mean, this is like it's been used for fertilizer forever, and that is that is a normal part of and an accepted part of farming. It's very common for most dairy farms do this. They if you have cows, you have a lot of manure, and so there are uses for it in other forms of agriculture that are good. The problem is it can just be too much, and the problems with the runoff, the problems when it does get into groundwater are serious too. The public health issues there are real, and so this is an attempt to walk the line there, as the DNR often finds itself in the situation of needing to restrict for the sake of the public while also needing to be cognizant of the actual practices and needs of the state's dairy farms.
And the DNR has come up with these guidelines. It's not a done deal yet, though, right?
Right. I mean, they'll go to Walker for a final sign-off. The legislature could also raise objections. They'll have a two-month period to do that. We'll see. But it sort of seems like they're on a fast track. We'll see.
And on a related story, Attorney General Brad Schimmel made an appointment for the head of the Justice Department's Environmental Protection Unit, and there's been some criticism of his choice. Why is that?
Sure. Anna J. Wildman is a lawyer who previously represented the Dairy Business Association, which is the largest dairy lobbyist in the state. This is not the DNR. This is the Justice Department,
right.
Their Environmental Protection Unit. So dealing with environmental violations, sometimes those can rise to the level of a crime. And so the criticism is that the leader, being a former dairy lobbyist, would tend to fall on one side of these disputes.
And what have we heard from the Justice Department about that?
Well, I mean, they say that she's qualified, and one thing that is true is that lobbyists do know a lot about the specific policies that affect a given industry. That is their job; it's what they're paid to know about. And so the Justice Department argument is that we won't hold her professional history against her. She has expertise. She can do this job. And there's a case there. It's just that the problem really comes when to the extent that lobbyists are experts, they're experts in representing one side, and not they're not representing the public interest. That's not that wasn't her job as a lobbyist. It is her job at the Justice Department. I don't know. I have no. Who knows? Maybe she can do that well. But those are the questions that are being raised.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories of the week in Wisconsin news. This week, Kimberly Clark, a paper business founded in Neenah, announced some big cutbacks. Details still up in the air now, but what are we hearing?
Sure. Well, the cutbacks are massive. 5,500 workers across the company and something like 12% of its global workforce. So it is a big reduction by a big company that is a major Wisconsin employer. They have factories in Neenah, in Appleton, and Marinette, and they employ about 3,000 people here. As you say, what we don't know is how many, if any, of the plant closures or layoffs will affect Wisconsin. We don't know yet.
And this is, I imagine, communities and workers, of course, waiting for the shoe to drop here about that information.
Yes, I mean it is among the largest employers in the Fox Valley, with Appleton and Neenah plants, right? So that alone is a lot of positions, and paper mill closures are a familiar story in Wisconsin, right? That is something that is a trend that has been happening over years. But this company, Kimberly Clark, specializes in, they make Kleenex or they make Huggies diapers, the types of paper products that, I think workers assume that there would still be a high demand for. And so I think it's, this is an uneasy time to be a Kimberly Clark employee, without a doubt.
And are local officials reacting to this, maybe trying to brace their communities even before we know what's going to happen?
Indeed, they apparently got no. It seems that Kimberly Clark officials were quite tight-lipped about this. The officials that our reporters spoke to and other reporters spoke to when the news broke appeared to be learning about it at the same time as the public announcements were made. Overall, the full scope of the reduction is going to play out over the next 3 years, the company said, and they're going to close. It's going to close 10 of its plants, but we don't know which ones. So yes, things like worker retraining and other assistance programs, the local officials can begin to put those things in place. We will get more details as the process proceeds, but. We don't have them now.
We'll keep watching that. And lastly, Rob, for anyone who's been to a Brewers game at Miller Park, they probably recognize this sound.
Here they come, ladies and gentlemen, down the left field line. It's time for the world-famous Clements Incredible Edible Racing Sausages.
Well, there's going to be a change there now, Rob, a change of sponsorship. What's happening?
Yes, I think everybody there was like a moment of panic that there might not be sausage races at Miller Park anymore, but that is not the case. However, they will no longer be the Clement sausage races. They will now be the Johnsonville sausage races. So that's that's a change. It's been 25 years that Clement has sponsored the group of five anthropomorphic encased meats who race around the base paths wearing funny hats for our enjoyment. It's the end of an era. It's going to be Johnsonville, which is also a Wisconsin company. Johnsonville is based in Sheboygan. So it is still a Wisconsin thing. But, this is a change for Milwaukee people, no doubt.
And, Rob, I have to thank you for another food racing-related story I briefly touched earlier on the show on something you tweeted about the end of cheese roll racing in Stilton in England.
I know. Can you believe it? What's wrong with the people of Stilton? Who's going to start that trend here? That needs to come to Wisconsin.
We will pick up the torch gladly. Rob, thanks as always.
All right. Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's with us about every week to look at some of the top stories from around the state. The Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin filed a federal lawsuit against the U.S. government this week over a pit sulfide mine near the Wisconsin-Michigan border. The Back 40 mine project along the Menominee River on the Michigan side has sparked controversy for the Menominee Tribe and others in the area who say it would disturb the source of the river. Patty Murray joins us now. She's reported on the mine and lawsuit for WPR News. Patty, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rob.
Well, give us the basics about this mine, first of all. This is on the Michigan side of the border, right?
Yeah, but just barely, really. It is a proposed 84-acre mine. That would be the footprint. And it's located basically within 150 feet of the Menominee River. Now, that river forms part of the border between Michigan's Upper Peninsula and Wisconsin. So very far northeastern Wisconsin, but technically, yes, in the state of Michigan.
So this is a Wisconsin tribe suing over a Michigan mine approved by a Michigan department, but they're suing the federal government. Sort that out for us.
Well, I'll try. Basically, the tribe filed suit, the Menominee filed suit in the Eastern District Federal Court in Wisconsin. That's located here in Green Bay. And they filed that suit on Monday. They're alleging that the Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers have wrongly delegated permitting authority to the state of Michigan. So that means that the state pretty much has the final say-so, and the tribe is alleging that that should not be.
And what's the grounds for that? Is it that, okay, it's going to affect this river that doesn't just live in Michigan, it also affects another state?
Well, I think that might be part of it, but also, for some reason, Michigan and New Jersey are two states that have authority other states don't over these sorts of regulatory permittings. Supposedly, that is because the states have a higher standard than the federal government. That is the other side of it. Aquila Resources would argue that it is proper to have the state of Michigan to oversee these permitting processes.
And then, as with a lot of mining projects we've seen on this side of the border in Wisconsin, there's controversy over this, and the company saying, hey, this will create jobs in the community and economic boost. What are the criticisms from the Menominee tribe on others about their worries about the impact of this mine?
Well, they're totally worried about the cultural sites, which I'm sure Chairman Bisaw will be able to go into much greater detail with you than I can. So, yes, there are cultural concerns about that, burial mounds and whatnot. There are also concerns about water discharges. This would be an open-pit sulfide mine, primarily gold and zinc, a little bit of copper, a little bit of silver, a little bit of lead. But so there are also concerns about discharges into the water. Now, Aquila Resources, the company behind the mine, says that all of the water that comes in contact with mining activities, they'll collect that. It'll be sent to a wastewater facility, which they equate to like a city water treatment plant. All of the runoff, the tailings, all the water would be treated before being put back into the Menominee River. That's what the company is saying.
With the tribal lawsuit now challenging the authority here, have you heard anything from the various parties, the U.S. government, the Michigan Environmental Department, or the mining company itself about the lawsuit itself?
Not really. They just filed the suit on Monday, so it's in its very early stages.
We'll leave it there for now. Patty, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Well, you're welcome, Rob.
That was Patty Murray, WPR reporter based in Green Bay, bringing us up to speed on a proposed mine in Michigan and the controversy surrounding it. Now we'll turn to Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin Chairman Gary Bisaw for more. Gary, welcome back to Central Time.
Why, thank you, Rob. I appreciate having the time to speak.
And Gary, what led you and the Menominee Tribe to file this lawsuit? What has you concerned here?
Well, several things. Partly the beds that are located within, there are tribal burial grounds, there are ancient agricultural sites. We have agricultural sites that stretch for miles along the Menominee River on both sides of the river, on both the Michigan and the Wisconsin side, that predate the Little Ice Age. We have burial mounds, we have ceremonial rings. This site along here and all the way to the mouth of the Menominee River. The Menominee River itself is indeed the site of the origin of the Menominee people. So this is of great importance to us. And when we look at the idea that the federal government has treaty and trust obligations, they have National Historic Preservation Act. We know through the National Environment Policy Act, NEPA, there are protections. We know we have many other types of protections federally, but when the state accepted that through the Clean Water Act, a Section 404 delegation of authority for the dredge and fill permit, once it got to the state level, not even one of those federal protections followed it, because they only are involved if it is a federal act. And by giving it to the state, once the state is making and having that determination and authority on the dredge and fill portion of the wetlands permit, well, then the state is telling us, well, we didn't make any treaties, or we don't have any trust obligation. So that's kind of where we're at.
The company behind the mine, staying with the sites you mentioned, the company said that it's done archaeological surveys of the area, hasn't uncovered anything of historical significance, says it would stop work if they did find something significant. What do you say to that?
Number one, they have not done an inclusive study. We know from earlier studies that there indeed this whole area, almost a 6-7 mile stretch along the river, with the 60 islands portion where the mine pit footprint would be, is a cultural landscape. There are not only those miles of garden beds, but there are many other introduced and recorded archaeological sites that the state of Michigan has that Aquila does not recognize in their studies. We believe that Aquila has been very selective in what they've put into those studies, and selectively had left out things that might give them discomfort, because then they would have to alter where their mine pit would be, for instance. So we see this. It's not clear what they're saying.
And you also, I understand, have concerns about environmental impact and the Menominee River itself. Can you talk about that?
Well, obviously, if we're looking at an open pit sulfide mine, and no open pit sulfide mine has ever, not polluted. So we're looking at it in an area that has a lot of water and a lot of the groundwater also, a lot of rain, a lot of groundwater. And obviously, people have heard that from us that and others, that when air and water mix with that sulfide in that open pit, see, it's not so much the gold and silver and everything. They extract those eventually will be fine. But the tailings that are left over, those stay forever. And when air and water mix with them, they make sulfuric acid. That's what you have in your car batteries. So those eventually get into the groundwater, and they do. And that's what any studies of the best scientific technological improvements in mining have still not solved that. How that gets into the water, and by the way, when it gets into the groundwater, it actually melts and releases other types of toxins also, because remember, it's sulfuric acid.
And Gary, I want to jump in because we just have a couple minutes left. Gary, with the lawsuit, with this legal action, are you hoping to completely stop the mine altogether, or trying to have more considerations for that environmental impact and those archaeological sites?
Well, when you hear the state of Michigan, or you hear Akilah say the state of Michigan has strong standards, they do not. They've looked at an environmental assessment over this. We want the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers to come in and really do a true assessment of this river and try to reduce the risks associated with it, and also to provide better protections for the land. Of course, we would rather not have it dug up, but if it came to it, the next step would be let's at least provide for those protections that we are guaranteed, or we should be through federal law, for the cultural sites, and a stronger protection for everybody living along the river and everybody who has to drink water from here or have wells through here, or even the Great Lakes.
We'll leave it there for now, Gary. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you, Roger. Appreciate it.
That's Gary Bisaw, chairman of the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin, talking about the tribe's lawsuit against the federal government related to a proposed mine near the Michigan-Wisconsin border on the Michigan side near the Menominee River. Coming up, we'll learn about a new federal rule going into effect soon that would change how tips are distributed to staff at restaurants and could allow restaurant owners in some cases to keep some or all of the tips. You can follow conversations like these anytime, anywhere with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Just download it at the app store of your choice. And then you can follow along to live conversations on the Ideas Network, the NPR News and Classical Music Network, and check out some archived conversations as well on your phone, tablet, or other device. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Now, a look at what happens when we tip at restaurants.
I got it. Don't worry.
Thanks, Larry.
You're welcome. So you know what they do here? It's an 18% tip included.
Yeah.
And then they have a space for an additional tip. You know, I have to start doing math in my head now. And then what does it come out to? $2? I'm leaving an extra $2. That makes me look cheap.
No, just leave the 18 and let's go.
Decided. I think that's all they expect.
I'm not leaving any more additional tips here.
No.
I'm protesting it. I swear to you, I'm going to protest it. I don't think it's right.
I'm going to follow your lead.
It's a good protest.
It's from the HBO show Curb Your Enthusiasm that illustrates some of the complications that happen when the check arrives and it's time to decide how much to tip your waiter. That's from the customer perspective. What's going on behind the scenes? What happens to that money? Are there differences over the people who get tipped, the wait staff, say, or the bartender, and the non-tipped employees, the bussers, the dishwashers, the cooks? Well, a new guideline from the Department of Labor will change that, will change the rules surrounding how tips are handled by restaurant owners. Here to fill us in on these changes now is Andrea Strong, a food writer who contributes to Eater.com, where she wrote about this. Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I think the casual restaurant customer, like me, might not even think about there being rules, existing regulations for how tips are handled. What is the current system?
Currently, if you are a waiter in New York City or across the country, you can be paid what's called a tipped wage, which means that because you are making supplemental income from the customer's tips, instead of being paid their full minimum wage, which the federal government says is $7.50, you can be paid $2.13 an hour. So it's much lower than the minimum wage, but they say that's fine because your tips are going to well cover that difference between the $2 and the $7. And that's called the tipped wage. And that difference, the five and something difference, is called the tip credit. And so when you go out to dinner right now, your tip is essentially subsidizing a restaurant's ability to pay their workers. So you're helping the restaurant meet their labor costs. by tipping the employees, which goes to the any service-facing job. So someone making your coffee, someone serving your wine, someone bussing your table. But the problem that's come up recently is that the people actually making your food, the cooks, the prep cooks, the chefs, the people washing your dishes, they're excluded from sharing in the tips. They make a regular straight minimum wage, $7.50 an hour. And but that discrepancy between what the back of the house, the people working in the kitchen, and the front of the house, the service-facing employees, that discrepancy is getting larger and larger, because a waiter working in a New York City restaurant can make, you know, several hundred dollars in tips a night, whereas the guy or girl making your dinner is just taking home their minimum wage times whatever hours they were there. So there's a big that's sort of what has been the catalyst for the discussion about changing tip laws.
And I'll spell out the changes announced by the Department of Labor. There's still a public hearing, or people can comment on this now. What are the changes they're proposing?
So under President Obama, if you no tips could not be shared between the front of the house and the back of the house. If you take the tip credit, meaning that you're paying your wait staff less than the minimum wage, you cannot share tips between front and back of the house. And if you decide, I'm not going to take the tip credit, I'm going to pay full minimum wage to waiters and cooks, Obama still said, you cannot share the tips. Tips are the property of the service-facing employee. What the Trump administration is proposing is to roll back the Obama rule and say, if you are paying everyone minimum wage, you're not taking the tip credit, everyone's getting paid, let's say, $7.50 an hour, then the tips are not the property of the person who earned them. They are not the property of the service-facing employee. They become the property of the restaurant. The restaurant manager can do with them what they want. If they want to share them between the waiters and the back of the house staff, they can. And I think, you know, people who are in favor of more equity between back and front of the house see this as a good thing. Well, if the manager can split the tips, great. That solves our problem. The cooks are getting their share and the waiters are getting their share, but the law does not provide for that. The law basically will say managers can do with those tips what they want. So there's no protection right now for the employees, for the people actually earning their tips. The management could just take them all.
Right, and that's been a point that's been most controversial about this. It seems like that it looks like, as you say, in these new regulations, these new guidelines, that if you're at a restaurant and you tip and you think it's going to your server, you're okay with that. Or, oh, it's being split between the server and the cook and the dishwasher, okay. You'd actually be just contributing to the bottom line at the restaurant, potentially.
Exactly. And the point that you make is a great one, because it's that lack of transparency. If you're out at a restaurant right now, you know your money is going to the server. If we're out at a restaurant post Trump changes in the tipping regulations, then you're not sure, because a restaurant can choose to do whatever they want. So it may, what worker advocates are saying is that it may actually reduce people's interest in tipping altogether if they don't know where it's going. Or you're going to have a conversation with the manager of your restaurant, every restaurant you go to, hi, how are you? Yes, I'll have the steak. And could you please explain to me exactly how your tips are distributed before I get my check so I can figure out what I'm going to do? It makes it, like, kind of ridiculous. It would be a very good Curb Your Enthusiasm episode. But, you know, it's that lack of transparency can really hamper a diner's interest in tipping if they don't know where it's going.
Talking to Andrea Strong. She's a food writer. She wrote about new proposed regulations on how tips are handled at restaurants. A public comment period going on now for the Department of Labor. Andrea, just as you were saying that, Deb on Facebook popped up with a comment. She says she would need restaurants to state what they do with tip money, before she sits down. Otherwise, she'll go elsewhere or covertly tip the server directly. So she, Deb, wants that transparency or she's walking.
Yeah, Deb, you know, you're not alone. That is a really a big concern of for worker advocates who say that this regulation doesn't really go far enough in protecting the restaurant worker and in giving diners the information that they need to tip properly. So there is a comment period going on right now. It will end February 4th. And right now, you can go onto the U.S. Department of Labor website, and you can see that there are over 300,000 comments, 303,759 to be exact. So if you have a few days, you could read through them. But I will just summarize for you that most of them are in opposition to this change in the rule. And for the reasons that we're discussing, that there's no transparency, that there's a really high likelihood that owners will just keep the money for themselves. It's, you know, I also should say it's extremely difficult to operate a restaurant right now. Restaurants are facing enormous costs. Rents, in particular in San Francisco and New York City, are incredibly high, and I'm sure you've seen in the papers that restaurants are closing at a higher rate than usual because of skyrocketing rents and an increase in the living wage, which, you know, I'm all for an increase in the living wage. People need to be able to put food on their table and support their families. The problem is that the restaurant business was not built on providing people with a living wage. It was built on providing people with the lowest wage possible and having the customer subsidize the labor cost with tips. So now, you know, if you're a small restaurant owner and you own like a, you know, a little Italian wine bar and your rent is going through the roof and now you're going to maybe have to pay, you're paying higher minimum wage because New York State has raised minimum wage, California has raised minimum wage. It's really becoming difficult for them to make ends meet. So restaurants definitely are having a hard time. And if then you have to, then you're saying, okay, well, pay everyone minimum wage. Don't take the tip wage for your front of the house people. So everyone's going to be getting the full minimum wage. That's a huge increase in their operating costs. And then you can share the tips on top of that. Well, maybe they're not going to want to share the tips on top of that because they have to pay everyone more minimum wage, and that they may want to keep those tips for themselves because they can, and it's been so difficult for them to make ends meet. So I think, you know, nothing's black and white, and there are definitely arguments on both sides. I think probably the biggest concern that I have is that these wages aren't going to get to the people that need them, and you know, it's almost impossible to find a way to satisfy everyone, to help the restaurants maintain their labor costs, and given all of the rises in rent and food costs, and help them operate successfully, but then pay their workers a living wage. It's really sort of a big conundrum.
Talking to Andrea Strong, food writer, reviewer for Eater.com, looking at a new federal guideline upcoming on how tips will be handled at restaurants. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this new tipping rule going to effect soon? Do you think tips should be pooled and distributed to the rest of the staff if the wait staff, the front end staff, are paid the full minimum wage? Is this a story about your life as a restaurant owner, a restaurant employee? Are you watching what's happening here? What do you think of the way tips work now? Do you think there needs to be a change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll take your calls and continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Andrea Strong, food writer, contributor to Eater.com. We're talking about a new federal rule that would change how employers distribute tips among restaurant staff. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in restaurants or someplace else that relies on tips. What do you think of the way things work now? What do you think of this idea of changing it, allowing employers to collect the tips, divvy them up among staff or not, in exchange for paying the front-end staff, the wait staff, the full minimum wage? As a consumer, what do you think of this idea? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls now, Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I spent 30 years in this industry, and the only way I could survive was on my tips. And I think that the service worker has just been degraded so much over the years. It's only getting worse. And I know you're talking about restaurants right now, but then will this eventually filter into the hotels so the maids don't get to keep their tips and the bellhops and the, you know, all the people that haul your luggage and whatnot and the chauffeurs, are they all going to lose their tips as well? I'm just wondering if this is going to become like a national let's pick on the service worker day.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Andrea, Cindy had a lot to say there. What do you think?
Well, Cindy, I feel you. I mean, hopefully it's not something that's going to be spreading to the hospitality industry. I think it is a restaurant-specific issue. So I don't see it moving into, like, bellmen and maids in hotels and that sort of thing.
Thanks a lot for that call. Go next to Ted on the line in Pembine. Ted, hi.
Hi there. The waitresses today are, they perform to get a good tip, and if they're going to take those tips away, your restaurants are struggling to find good waitresses and waiters to begin with. Leave them alone. Tax something else, or, you know, figure out a different way of getting it, you know, making the money.
Mm-hmm.
Ted, thanks for the call. So, hard for restaurants to get good wait staff. Anyway, without those tips, it might be even harder.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, some restaurants have moved away from tipping altogether, like the Danny Meyer Restaurant Group pioneered that a few years ago, and it's tough. I mean, Danny is paying everyone a better wage. He's paying front and back of the house the same higher minimum wage. But in order to do that, he's had to raise prices of his entrees, and maybe that will mean that people are going to be eating out less, and the waiters who are making hundreds of dollars a night on their tips are making less, so it's harder for them to stay there. They may go to a restaurant that is a tipping restaurant instead.
Thanks a lot for that call. Go next to Ed on the line in Dodgeville. Ed, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm totally against any type of change because these people, I mean, if you're in the industry, they work. I mean, there are people that just work their butts off. And when my wife and I go out and frequent certain restaurants, we ask for specific servers because we know that these people are top shelf, and they go out of their way, and to change the rule, it's insane. We won't go, or I will pay under the table. I'll make sure that the person that takes care of me gets what they deserve and not going to anybody else or the owner.
Ed, thanks for the call. Andrea, for Ed, some waiters are stars.
Yeah, but I think the issue that maybe is getting lost is that, you know, restaurants don't have to adopt this law. This is an option that will now exist that didn't exist before. So they can keep things as is. They can keep everything the way it is, or they can decide to pay everyone a minimum wage, do not take the tip credit, and then they can decide what to do with the tips. So they don't have to do it. It's an option. The other thing is that because of this comment period on the law and these 300,000 comments in opposition to this change, the Department of Labor actually has to respond to all of these comments. Under the law, they have to give a reason why the opposition comments were not persuasive to them. So it's going to take probably 6 months to a year for the Department of Labor to, once the comment period is over, for them to figure out what they're going to do. They could do one of three things. They could say, you know what, these 300,000 comments, they make a lot of sense, and we're rescinding this rule and we're keeping everything the same. That's probably not likely. Second thing they could do is say, you know what, these 300,000 comments, some of them make a lot of sense, and we are going to revise the rule. So they could come back with a rule that says if you pay your employees full minimum wage and you don't take the tip credit, then tips become shareable between back and front of the house, and management is explicitly excluded from sharing in those tips. And that way you get this added protection and the safety for your workers, that they are the ones who are going to be sharing in those tips, not management. So it's possible that they could come back with that, or it's possible they could say all 300,000 of you are wrong, we're right, and given our current president, I wouldn't doubt him to do that, and we're going forward with this rule as we planned it.
Thanks for that call, Ed. Andrea, in our last couple minutes, I want to throw in a new wrinkle that you wrote about. We're talking about how things work in law and in theory. You write that in practice, you see in restaurants sometimes wage theft, time theft, things like that affecting employees. Can you talk about that a little?
I'm sorry, I missed the...
You wrote about wage theft a little bit in your piece, that even under the system as it's supposed to be, it doesn't always work out right.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of dishonest people in this world, and some employers are already stealing tips from waitresses and waiters and bartenders, and it's a huge problem. There's an enormous number of lawsuits against casinos and large restaurant chains for back wages. I mean, I think even, not that Mario Batali needs another lawsuit on his hands, but he was sued for wage theft maybe a year ago or so. So there's a lot of people out there who are not doing the right thing. And I think this legislation just opens the door for more people to do the wrong thing and do it legally instead of illegally.
We'll leave it there for now. Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob. This was really fun. Have a great night.
You too. That was Andrea Strong. She's a longtime food writer. She contributes to Eater.com. We've been talking about new federal rule going into effect soon. There's a public comment period. It would change how tips are distributed to staff at restaurants. The Department of Labor, as Andrea mentioned, is taking comments on this, 300,000 plus of them right now. You can find that on the Department of Labor website. If you want to comment more locally, you can still share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you work in the restaurant industry as a restaurant owner or manager or wait staff or back end staff, love to hear what you think does happen when it comes to tips. What should happen as you see it when it comes to tips? Let us know again on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, President Trump addressed international trade on a global stage this week, a big international conference. A Wisconsin expert on trade digs into the issues and tells us what's at stake, from our local North American Free Trade Agreement to the World Trade Organization, new tariffs on foreign products, including solar panels and washing machines, and the risk of a possible trade war with China, South Korea, and others. We'll talk to the author of a new book on secularism and look at how religion and politics coexist comfortably and sometimes uncomfortably in the United States and in countries around the world. And we're going to check out some of the big winners at this weekend's Grammy Award ceremony. You can let us know right now if you are planning to watch, if you have favorites, or if you really just don't keep track of the latest music and who's winning the awards. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday after 8, the creators of the Doomsday Clock advanced it forward, saying the risk of nuclear destruction has gotten worse. It's increased. Find out why with Kate and her guest. That's Monday after 8 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll learn about some comments Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson made about bias in the FBI and then appeared at least to partially take back, and some reaction to those comments from around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.